This year saw widespread commentary on and commemoration of the Brown v. Board of Education decision during this 50th anniversary year. When Ralph Ellison heard of the High Court's decision, he wrote, "So now the court has found in our favor and recognized our human psychological complexity and citizenship, and another battle of the Civil War has been won. The rest is up to us, and I'm very glad." For him, the Brown case showed how Black Americans, quote, turned the Supreme Court into the forum of liberty it was intended to be, and the Constitution of the United States into a briar patch in which the nimble people, the willing people, have a chance, end quote. And a decade later, Ellison would write that the Brown decision and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, quote, induced no sudden transformation of character. It provided the stage upon which they could reveal themselves for what their experiences have made them and for what they have made of their experiences. Ellison always acknowledged that Black Americans had suffered by law and custom from racial prejudice. Echoing in his own way the premises of Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, Ellison said of Blacks in America, "Our social mobility was strictly and violently limited, and in a way that neither our Christianity nor belief in the principles of the Constitution could change." Nevertheless, Ellison argues that they were not simply victims of the majority white society. They drew upon their own wit and resources to fashion a way of life, especially in the South, that contributed to the growth and development of the United States. With racial bigotry an American reality for the foreseeable future, Ellison still argued that, quote, "the obligation of making oneself seen and heard was an imperative of American democratic individualism," end quote. That said, racial prejudice still tainted policy discussions a decade after the Civil Rights Movement reached its apex in the mid-1960s. Ellison described how the anger erupting among young Blacks in the 1970s was more than just a reaction to overt bigotry. Quote, "It makes them furious when whites respond to their complaints with, 'Yes, but I had nothing to do with any of that,' or reply to their demands for equal opportunity in a racially rigged society, 'We're against a quota system because we made it on our own individual merits.' Because this not only sidesteps a pressing reality, but is only partially true. Perhaps they did make it on it their own. But if that's true, the way was made easier because their parents did not have to contend with my parents, who were ruled out of the competition." It's not that Ellison wanted his white neighbors to bend over so that he could. To get even. Rather, as he put it, the point is one of moral perception, the perception of the wholeness of American life and the cost of its successes and its failures. Because Blacks in America have been viewed as a group, according to their color, as opposed to their individual character and experience, many white Americans tend to perceive them as living an entirely separate existence, wholly apart from the reality of American society, where Blacks were never far from the social, economic, or political action of the greater community. Now, this moral blind spot to the presence of Blacks and hence to their contribution, willing and otherwise, to America's prosperity divides whites from Blacks to this day. After the civil rights victories of the mid-1960s, Black nationalism and separatism was on the rise. Ellison saw this as an ill-conceived reaction to white supremacy. He considered it just another form of secession. He lamented that, quote, "certain Negroes who for years have been satisfied to be merely human and stake their chances upon individual attainment are succumbing to Blackness as a value," end quote. He blamed militant leaders of the Black Power movement like Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown for preaching the repudiation of middle-class values for the emotionally satisfying but intellectually vacuous reason of rejecting all things white. To reject American values as merely white values was to reject much of what made Black Americans who they were, as well as what and who made America what she was. These so-called reformers failed to acknowledge that the American experience included Black as well as white contributions, or as Ellison liked to put it, whatever else the true American is, he is also somehow Black. As you might expect, Ellison was criticized in the wake of the Black Power movement for not doing enough in his writings to promote the cause of civil rights. What the black nationalist failed to understand was that his writing promoted the civil rights movement, only in a different way than turning his writing into mere propaganda. Just after World War II, Ellison wrote, "A people must define itself, and minorities have the responsibility of having their ideals and images recognized as part of the composite image, which is that of the still-forming American people," which is precisely what he did in his great 1952 novel, Invisible Man. Ellison was devoted to elevating the humanity of black Americans by incorporating their story into the story of America without trading on racial stereotypes or pat sociological formulations. Also, by writing well, by perfecting his craft instead of turning it into mere political sloganeering, Ellison tried to show all Americans that from the equality of human beings can rise the individuality that brings forth excellence. Ellison argued that even where freedom was professed full voice but limited by the color line, individuals had the wherewithal to make themselves known. He praised Richard Wright for accepting, quote, his own individual responsibility for seeing to it that America become conscious of itself, end quote. He saw in Wright's ambition and devotion to his writing a moral assertion that flowed from a long-standing black American tradition of not trading on one's own anguish for gain or sympathy. This acceptance of the challenge of his own human freedom led Wright to publish Native Son, the first Book of the Month Club selection authored by a black American in 1940, the same year John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath came out, as well as Ernest Hemingway's For Whom the Bells Tolled. Ellison said of Wright, like a good Negro athlete, he believed in his ability to compete. Ellison believed that black Americans, despite being the targets of discrimination, drew from their own humanity to ride out the burden of an oppression at odds with American ideals. The majority of black Americans have long believed that the founding principles of the nation, as long as white Americans continue to profess them, would continue to work their way into the American psyche and practice. Ellison's belief in human equality surfaces in his writings through his affirmation of individual responsibility, even in the face of less than ideal circumstances. Unlike proponents of strict multiculturalism and identity politics, who interpret the American experience of blacks as if they were proponents of racial reductionism, Ellison emphatically denied that blacks were merely the sum total of their experience under slavery and segregation. Quote, "If you have a society in which all men are created equal, then it seems to me that you must act out of an assumption that any people which has not been destroyed after 300 years of our history, which is still here among us, is a people possessing great human potentialities and strengths which its members have derived from their background." Himself a black writer living in a predominantly white America, Ellison believed that a person's individuality is still operative beyond the racial structuring of American society. Although constrained by racial prejudice, by law and custom, black Americans were also participants in what Ellison called a broader American cultural freedom, and this reposed a responsibility in each citizen both to think and to act well. Ellison took pride in the example of blacks in his home state of Oklahoma, who exhibited a moral exuberance in the face of discriminatory conditions. Quote, "For in that state our people fought back. We seldom won more than moral victories, but we fought back, as can be seen from the many civil rights victories that were initiated there, and as can be heard in Southwestern jazz. We were an assertive people, and our mode of social assertion was artistic, mainly musical, as well as political." Ellison also believed that America was a society in flux, producing what he called the sheer unexpectedness of life in these United States. Ironically, for segregated America, this allowed blacks to exercise their natural freedom more than what their environment might appear to permit. An obvious example is Ellison's own discovery of English literature while attending a vocational school, Tuskegee Institute, and on a music scholarship at that. No one told him which books to read or to avoid, for that matter, which meant he was literally free to read far and wide and to learn from those who, quote, were in the position to observe from the very top of the society to the very bottom, end quote. This is one of the great ironies of segregation, Ellison thought. He said they never thought that we would actually read these books, so we were free to do so without them even knowing.
This is why Ellison exhorted black students in the 60s to read novels. Yes, novels even written by white males, dead white males for that matter. Precisely because blacks had been choked off from knowing how society operates. He'd always say, it's in the books. Go read them. Reflecting on what he, a black American, learned from Ernest Hemingway's characters, who lived outside the values of the larger society, as Ellison put it, he claimed, it doesn't have to be, thank God, about Negroes in order to give us insights into our own predicament. Ellison appreciated his friend and writer Richard Wright for his testimony as a black boy raised in Mississippi, but, quote, who grew up and who achieved through his reading a sense of what was possible out there in the wider world. Moreover, Wright wanted to be tested, quote, in terms of his talent, not in terms of his race or Mississippi upbringing. At stake was the American principle of human equality, not racial equality. And Wright was right in choosing the best human writers, not merely black writers, as his standard for measuring his own achievements. It was a choice Ellison ached for from an early age, as he observed in a reminiscence about growing up in segregated Oklahoma. Quote, it was said by word of mouth, proclaimed in newsprint, and dramatized by acts of discriminatory law that you were inferior. You were barred from vying with them in sports games, competing in the classroom, or the world of art. Yet what you saw, heard, and smelled of them left irrepressible doubts, so you ached for objective proof, for a fair field of testing, end quote. At a 1966 Senate hearing on America's urban ghettos, as they called it at the time, Ellison suggested that instead of government treating black Americans, quote, as though we are being legislated for, rather than with, laws should grant to each Negro his individuality, end quote. This would help the diverse individuals within the United States get to know one another, quote, without the myths of racial inferiority or superiority, end quote. Simply put, Ellison, in my estimation, did not believe that race should be the measure of anyone's rights. When it comes to securing the rights of all Americans, it's the minority of one, the individual, that should be the focus of the Constitution's protection. Of course, this belies current pleas for group representation to promote diversity. Driven by an identity politics hostile to the rights of the individual, today's affirmative activists have balkanized college campuses as they seek to entrench a system of color-coded benefits and burdens. But according to Ellison's Invisible Man, it's winner-take-nothing that is the great truth of our country or of any country. A truly common good, I argue, will arise as we protect the diversity not only of the people, but of each individual, and not the racial isolationism of misguided multiculturalists. Quote, let man keep his many parts, and you'll have no tyrant states, the Invisible Man says. And echoing the national motto, E Pluribus Unum, he adds, America is woven of many strands. I would recognize them, and let it so remain. Now, when critics chastised Ellison for preaching individualism to blacks instead of racial solidarity, he referred them to the jazz giants of old, whom he called the stewards of our vaunted American optimism. Ellison argued that blacks took pride in Duke Ellington and Johnny Hodges, quote, not because they were anonymous bumps within the crowd, but because they were themselves. He reminded them, if the white society has tried to do anything to us, it has tried to keep us from being individuals. And he noted the irony in black leaders, or so-called black leaders, who decried black individualism while they themselves were doing all they could to suppress all individuality but their own. Proud to be a Negro American, Ellison did not believe that true freedom or human excellence would be found down the road to color consciousness. As he put it, quote, I don't expect any special provisions to be made for me because I'm a Negro who's trying to write novels. Ellison was once asked if he thought the Harlem Renaissance failed. This is a quote from Nat Hentoff yesterday. Stole it from me. Because it did not create institutions to preserve the gains of black Americans, to which Ellison replied, no, we do have institutions. We have the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and we have jazz. Without the Constitution and Bill of Rights as political touchstones for freedom of expression, even within a racially prejudiced society, the black man's scope to create great art would be even more limited. Ellison was always quick to remind his audience, black or white, not to overlook what Negroes already possessed and could claim as their own. But why the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? How were these the possession of a historically marginalized segment of America? Ellison believed these pillars of American government must be claimed by and for black Americans to the same extent as whites in order to affirm the equal humanity and Americanness of the Negro. Ellison's dream, like that of Martin Luther King Jr., was deeply rooted in the American dream. No white bigot's ignorance of the text of his own nation's political charter and ignorance of the very basis of his own freedom ought to stand in the way of black Americans claiming and acting upon that same charter of freedom. That would give up the struggle before it began, to say nothing of neglecting the effort and sacrifice of many a thousand gone who had literally a head, hand, and heart in establishing the American regime. Though the nation's founders committed what Ellison called the sin of racial pride, they also committed the ideal of human equality to paper. This gave blacks, in Ellison's mind, the firmest ground for securing their rights as Americans. As for jazz, it was an art form that antedated and survived the Harlem Renaissance. Ellison saw jazz as both a means and an end of Negro American freedom. It not only existed as a body of musical expression with its own techniques and traditions, but also testified to the capacity of black Americans to thrive as artists even within a segregated America. By creating music that gave opportunity across the color line to excel, black Americans offered a beacon of hope to others who would dare to succeed in what little or great scope of freedom the majority white society permitted. And as black musical excellence made itself known to wider audiences, but especially to black audiences, interests beyond musical ones were piqued. The young Ralph Ellison could, at first, strive to become a world-class trumpeter and classical composer, only to be emboldened further to try his hand at writing. Ellison once said that he knew no writers, but he knew many musicians, many excellent musicians. He grew up with Charlie Christian, among others. Their excellence in the face of discrimination gave Ellison hope and inspiration to write. While Ellison was a New Deal Democrat to the core, his writings were anything but doctrinaire reflections of what we would consider modern-day liberalism. A man who received both the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Lyndon Johnson and the National Medal of Arts from Ronald Reagan can hardly be placed in a political box. Writing as the consummate insider-outsider, Ellison offered his prose as an appreciative critique of American society. In this, he echoed Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote in Democracy in America, "It is because I was not an adversary of democracy that I wanted to be honest with it." In Ralph Ellison, we find an American writer who loved his country enough to be honest with it. And it is that honest appraisal of human individuality in a free and diverse America that can help, I think, bridge our present racial divide. Thank you.